went through a little bit of a hell. We had €1 million on the table from someone, and we were closing, and we were going to close 1.5, and the million evaporated, and we literally got ghosted by the investor.
I love that description.
Just
wow.
Yeah, overcrowded.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of season 2 from the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast. I'm your host, Gary Fox. This week we have Andrea Wade. Andrea is the founder of Opening.io, a very interesting tech company based right here in Dublin. Andrea is not your standard tech founder in that she has a really varied background spanning journalism, marketing, and events. Starting off in computer science when she was young, she deviated into journalism and has made her way back into tech. So she's a really good story to tell and kind of bounce around, including her time spent in Drogheda. So I won't ruin that for you. So without further ado, here is Andrea Wade, the founder of Opening.io. Enjoy the episode. Andrea, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. So good to be here.
A belated attempt. We did a false start. Now we're off.
Yeah, it's all good though.
Give us a tiny little intro to yourself.
Sure. Well, right now I am the co-founder and CEO of Opening.io. We're a data science company based here in Dublin. My background, sometimes I describe it that my background is in everything. So I majored in computer science in secondary school. So I was coding when I was 16. I went off to become a journalist. I did TV, I did radio. Then I went off and I organized large music fests.
Oh wow.
So I'd done
we've a lot to talk about already.
So a lot of music fests. Then I started, this is my fourth company. I've done from mentoring in incubators and accelerators to actually investing in European startups as well. I was part of a fund and were investing in European startups. I lectured, I organized many hackathons and startup weekends and was very, very much part of the community. And then I always did 4 or 5 things at the same time. And then Opening started and I just started saying no to everything else.
It's hard, isn't it, though? I think that's every entrepreneur's curse. You're always attracted by like, oh, I could be doing this and I could do this and I could do this and I could do this. And then you get that one big project and you have to backburn a lot of things for a while.
Yeah, I think for me, and this might sound, different, but I really had a moment when I remember rejigging my Twitter profile, and I had doing this and doing that because I was doing startup hiking. We would take people hiking and ask it on all these, and I just literally erased everything and I said building Opening.
Yeah,
it felt like decluttering your house, or I don't know, it's just
no, I get it. Yeah,
it was a moment.
It's so hard to focus on so many things.
It is. And I very often talk to Adrian and I. Adrian is my co-founder. There's 2 people in Opening. And he calls this our test of maturity, in a way. Just focusing on one thing and focusing it from beginning to end, wherever end will be. Mm. So because he was the same, just doing loads of things. I guess it's our maturity test.
I think that's a stage you go through as well, because you're sampling. You're trying to figure out, what do I like? Where is the opening? And you kind of have to, for me, it's all about momentum. Like this podcast is about momentum, moving forward, meeting new people, building new connections, getting new ideas. Like sitting here talking to you, in the next hour, we'll have discussed hundreds of ideas. So there's definitely a balance, but then you do need to be able to focus hugely on building something. So tell us a little bit about Opening. We'll start there and then I've got to jump back to a lot of those things you talked about already.
Sure. So Opening, well, again, 2 founders, it's myself and Adrian, no background in recruitment, right? Because really what we've built, we have what we call a recommender engine for the talent industry, for the recruitment and HR industry. And really what we do is we build algorithms that understand jobs, understand resumes, all sorts of other data pieces, and we match it together. But we came at this from our own experience as being candidates, maybe hiring managers, but we never worked as recruiter. We knew 0 of the industry, which is a little bit of a mad thing to do. And I do not recommend starting a business in an area that you don't really know much about. But really, it was Adrian's story as well. So Adrian is, he moved to Ireland about 6 years ago from Transylvania and Romania. He was a really old, like an old friend of mine. But his background was programming Olympiad. So he won the programming Olympics back in Romania ages ago. He had a previous startup. They grew it from 0 to 70. Apple nearly bought them. In the end, Wedding Wire bought them in New York. Everything that he did turned into something. And then he decides, I want to go to a tech hub where I want to work with interesting people on interesting problems with different technologies. And he sends off his CV to, funny enough, Dublin and San Francisco. And long story short, he gets 2 offers in San Francisco and 3 in Dublin. But the company he chooses to go work with was a company that interviewed him 7 or 9 times. And his CV was they had his CV 3 months before it was rediscovered by an external recruiter and put back in there for a five figure finder's fee. So his CV was on the computer, in an email, in a file somewhere, and nobody really understood who they had, because this is a company that will talk to you, sign 7 times or 9 times to figure out, are you it?
I think it's bonkers.
It is bonkers.
I think it's bonkers. I hate the whole scene. I think it's mental.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people justifying their jobs. And I've had the exact same scenario. I was brought in and Jordan was like 10 minutes late. And I'm sitting there and chatting away for 10, 15 minutes. And I got around to my French levels. I was like, I don't speak French.
Right.
You're on job.
Right.
Oh, no, we'll call you back. I was like, what? It's bonkers. Like, and often it's just people just slotting someone in because they need to hit their quota for Q1 of people. It's a mad industry.
It really is. And very often at the very beginning when I used to pitch this product, and we used to kind of anchor it in the recruitment industry, but we called it the rejection industry. And we're like, this is how it happens, and these are the problems within it, and this is how you experience it from a candidate perspective, and this is the solution that we have to the problem. And really for us, it was, we were product people and we were getting very, very much interested in machine learning and AI and all that. So we worked on it weekends and evenings for about 9 months. And then 9 months later, we decided this might be a thing, and we decided to incorporate.
Okay. He had moved here at this stage.
He was here. Yeah, he was already here. He was in a job. I had a previous company at that stage. But, you know, evenings, weekends, this is what we were doing.
You kind of felt, yeah, there's definitely, it kind of kept your interest.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we put it out there and I started meeting people and I put it onto LinkedIn and I kind of said, well, we're doing this thing. And then
it's real.
The industry started, you know, coming and talking to me, and we got in, you know, just random, literally a random around the internet on LinkedIn went, I think this is a very interesting idea. My friend owns this very large recruitment agency. I can get a meeting. Do you want to meet him? And I'm like, oh, yes, please. So suddenly we landed in this industry. And I guess what I brought to this at the very beginning was a network that I could tap into and go, can you answer some questions, or can you help? Can you introduce us? Can you? And that's how it started.
What do you envision? What was your vision for it at the start? What did you see it? You know, what was the kind of the thing on the wall where you're looking at going, right, that's what we're doing?
If we are to use fancy simple words, we just really wanted to connect good people together. Because we spend most of our lives or most of our days or weeks or whatever, we spend them in an office, in a place, because we all have to work. Right. And we wanted to do that. We wanted to bring good people together. And I guess at a really, really small scale, you know, I was doing that. Adrian was doing that, in the sense that we both had a big network, and we, every time I would meet a new person or something, I would go, oh, you know what? You should meet this and this, or this company who's, you know, I'm a friend with their founder and they're looking for a person. You two should talk. We always had this. And I guess the vision was connecting, bringing good people together. It's funny, we had an offsite in December and brought the team in, and I pulled up our first ever deck in 2015.
Okay.
And really, and it was interesting for me as well that our vision has not changed.
Oh, that's interesting.
How we executed and how we got there, of course, there is no straight line. But really about the, we always wanted to be a data science company. We only sell APIs. We don't have a product. A data science company that builds these models and really just build good matching tech. Because in our industry, it's a little bit of a holy grail. Build matching tech that understands the CVs, understands the jobs, understands maybe other external data points, understands the nuances, can predict and build something that can automate and help the humans make better decisions and help the candidates get a better experience than the one that you got or most of us are
a getting. Lot of my friends work in tech, and it's just never a week goes by whereby there hasn't been some colossal error on internal hiring. It's a huge one as well. You know, something happens. Oh no, actually we bring this person in because this, this and this. It's mad. Like, and then the turnover is huge in tech firms. I think for a lot of that reason. You know?
Huge. I think right now it's, what is it? It was 1.8 years a tech worker stays in a job, but now that's come down to a year or something.
Really?
It's
people just
jump for reasons.
Especially here as well. You know, you have a multitude of choice.
Oh my God. I mean, Adrian literally, he deleted his LinkedIn profile because he was
tormented.
Yeah, that was it. He's like, I'm gone. I don't.
But that's a perfect example of why your software is needed as well, because you just have recruiters spamming. One recruiter tried to hire my friend for the same job twice.
Wow.
You know, it's just... Okay. You know, it's bonkers. Like, so when you say, just to skip back, when you say you don't have a product that you sell, how does it work then?
So we plug into, so we sell to industry.
Okay.
We have some agencies that have bought our tech, and we bolted into their applicant tracking system. So ATS or CRM, candidate management.
Yeah.
But really our core... market and a target market and sweet spot customer is the job board or the ATS, the applicant tracking system itself.
Yeah.
And very often what we do is we sell into, so our buyer is CTO in the company and VP of product. They use our tech and they productize it. They might build a product around it or they might plug it into their existing product and add new features. So I think 95% of our clients buy our tech to build something new rather than to replace something old.
Interesting.
So, and with that, they build new products and they actually end up with new business models as well. So you would have job boards that come to us in the States mainly, and they go, well, we have all this candidate data and we're building this candidate community, but we don't really tap into it meaningfully. We just say to employers, hey, put your job up and whoever applies, applies, and that's it. But we could actually do something with that community. But we've never looked at it that way. So, you know, we really change products and business models for companies as well.
Is that difficult?
Yes.
Not having a product.
Yes.
We're business, but we don't product. No, what I mean is, like, in a way, I would imagine it's so much easier in the fact that you're not selling to anyone, everyone. You know, so when you're very niche, it's actually much easier. But I'd say it's tough as well, because...
The reason why it's tough really is because we really sell into the... We're always talking at C-level,
yeah,
and even large companies. It's a C-level type of talk. It's a strategic buy. And really, see, the thing is, when you talk to HR directors within this, you know, within our industry, they talk about, hey, vendors, could you all just talk to each other and integrate into each other? Because we can't have, you know, sometimes 5, 7, 12 products that they use in order to do their end-to-end.
Yeah, and hack them all together and make them work.
Yeah, so integration is just such a big thing. So we did not want to build another ATS or another CRM. We did not want to compete with them.
Okay.
We just wanted to do one thing and one thing only and do it really, really well because we knew what it meant. Like, I don't know if you had the same experience, but even 2 days ago, I was looking at a tweet from a CEO who actually said, this is a new one, LinkedIn. LinkedIn suggested to her a pilot job. And I mean, she's, you know, she's the CEO of a tech company, but it has nothing to do with flying or whatever. So... You know, if this whole matching thing would be hacked, you would see it working really meaningfully on LinkedIn or whatever. So we said, look, we're only going to do this one thing, do it really, really well, and sell the API and sell it into the industry. It took a while until we got there, although we knew really from day one that we don't want to be a product company.
Okay. And how, you know, when you start off, how did you get those first couple of sales? You know, how did you develop the product to such a stage where you get in front of C-level people? Because that's a quite big ask for any company, never mind a brand new one.
Yeah. Absolutely. And funny enough, we have moments now this year and last year when you kind of have to stop and see, you know, how much you progressed and the fact that you are now going into these C-suite, you know, rooms and you're talking to these people and it suddenly became more accessible because we're proven to a certain extent. But in the very beginning, we worked with some startups. Some of them died in the meantime. So job boards,
common enough, yeah.
You know, job boards that took our tech and we were like, yeah, no problem. And some of them have grown. Mm. So we literally have clients that we maybe charged in the very beginning a couple of hundred euros here and there. And now we signed, you know, a five figure or a six figure kind of contract. Mm. So some of these things, you know, paid off. I think one big change for us was when the CEO of a big Irish agency kind of knocked on our door and said, what are you doing there? I'm kind of interested in seeing. So I'm like, well, this.
Did they get it?
They did. Sir, their CTO did.
Okay.
Really, really well. There was a bit of a struggle at user level to get it. There was fear as well. Mm. I have been in rooms where the recruiter will say, well, why would I use this? I'm just helping it learn and it'll put me out of a job. It doesn't.
That was going to be one of my questions. Yeah,
it doesn't quite work like that. And it doesn't just learn. And that's a misconception that people have.
The machines are taking AI. Over.
we're not there yet. It doesn't, you know, you don't want it to learn your behavior because, you know.
You spent half an hour on Facebook already this morning, Mary.
Well, you know, so it doesn't quite work like that. But people don't know, right? Mm. So I could just see as well as the years have passed how people started understanding how they can use these things. Use cases have developed because in our world there is one thing to, you know, you could have brilliant data scientists playing with models and building these things, but then you have to deploy them. They have to work within a context and then they have to be useful. They have to be useful for the end users. And those are the use cases. And they are worth like gold today, figuring out, okay, we have smart people in the room who can build cool stuff, but is it useful?
Mm. Show me, don't tell me. That's always the one, isn't it?
Like
you can explain something to someone 100 times, whereas you'll open your laptop and go, well, this is it. See, it does that. And then you're like, oh,
exactly.
I get it now.
Exactly. And
the
you
fear
know,
one's a big one.
When you're an API company, bit difficult to like, how do we demo this? So in the very beginning, we actually build what we call a mini applicant tracking system, because we couldn't just say imagine.
Yeah.
Like, imagine what? So we had to put a thing in front of people and go, here's the data, here's the thing, smash it together and see if it works. So people got it when they were able to put in jobs that they had open in the last, whatever, 3 months, put in the candidates that they applied, knowing exactly who was shortlisted, who got to interview.
That's interesting.
And then seeing what the machine says. And that's when things kind of started clicking and they were like, oh yeah, I get this and I get how this can be useful, especially when we're targeting clients who have millions and millions and millions in CVs, or these big applicant tracking systems or CRMs who sometimes have a couple of hundred million CVs or whatever.
Okay.
But even, I mean, any job, imagine you put a job description out there and you get 100 people applying. That's a lot. 100 people, 100 CVs, that's a book.
Yeah,
because she's a very good point, don't have just one.
And you can't just read through it once. You have to read through it and go get a sense of who they are.
Yeah.
You know, okay, they did this, then they did that, then they did this, and then they changed that. And you have to kind of go back and kind of understand their journey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of it.
in a short summary, take me back. So computer science to journalism.
Yeah.
Most people would kill to have a computer science degree or a computer science background. What took you into journalism?
So, you know, I'm originally from Transylvania, Romania. I came here when I was 22, but I published my first article when I was 16.
Okay.
Post-communist Romania. It just, it felt that if you have the pen and can hold the pen and you can write things about what is going on or you know, how things should be or some injustices or whatever. So I just wanted to tell stories, but I wanted to serve society, I guess. And that was, that's really how it started. And I remember making my mom cry, telling her that I'm gonna be a kind of war journalist. Like I'm gonna go away and get deployed and I'm gonna write about all these things. And every time I would say this to her, she would cry. I stopped crying. but I think it was that bit of there was just so much change happening in the country, and I found so much unfairness, and I just wanted to write about that or write good stories.
Okay.
One thing that I've never done, and I'm very opinionated about about not writing opinion pieces. That was never my thing, and I still find them, I can't really digest them that much.
I skip over them myself. Unless it's someone with a huge authority. Generally, they're not journalists. I read, you know, someone's a sports manager or someone's a specialist.
Yeah,
I'll read that because I feel as bad. But people who write opinion pieces and that's their job, I don't really get it.
No. So I was always interested in facts and I was interested in stories. So I did radio as well. I did TV as well. But it wasn't necessarily for me, not when it comes to news, because I was in the news department. But you had to run out into the field, get the news, come back, write a really short radio piece, write a TV. I liked to just sit and write.
Tell the full story.
Yeah.
It's quite transactional, actually, the news.
Yeah. It was not
man, funny. 22, in wherever, Dublin City Centre, did this, end of story.
And it was just really, I don't know, everyone in the TV department was a bit mad. I found it was, everyone was really stressed, like, get it in, and screaming, and I was like, yeah, this is not, like, just let me sit in a room and write about the thing.
Two very different skills as well.
And I liked having longer conversations with people as well, rather than just very quickly, you know, what happened, give me 10 seconds, 20 seconds or whatever.
And how did you decide, okay, so you're doing journalism now in Romania. How did you decide then to come to Dublin? We actually talked about this earlier. Why people make decisions.
Well, See, I always wanted to go to an English-speaking country. Okay. It was the thing that I wanted to do. I didn't yet finish college, so I had one more year left. Okay. And I went and I interviewed this guy, this Irish guy, my senior editor. It was a week where I had no story.
Okay.
And I think I was a bit meh and I had no big story. And she went, go and talk to this Irish guy who brings people over to Ireland. They stay here for a few years. They work in kitchens or in hospitality. And then they come back to Romania and they open restaurants and things. And this guy is interesting because not only that he just takes people there, he teaches them how to do this, whatever. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I go and I interview this guy and I'm putting together a story. And at the end, the interview finishes and he's telling me, you know, usually I'm interviewing people. This feels, you know, weird, but you've been really good. Would you be interested in going to Ireland? I'm like, oh.
He's always selling that guy. I like it.
Yeah, always be closing. That's what he was doing. And I'm like, well, maybe. I go home and, well, I tell my editor, she's like, how did it go? Oh, yeah, great. And he kind of offered me a job. And I tell my mom, she starts crying again.
Yeah. Where's Ireland? God, it's other end of the world.
But I always, always, always just had a thing for Ireland. So I considered it. And long story short, I ended up here. And in the first year and a half of my life, I worked in security.
Wow.
Yeah. This is what
did
I did.
Did you take the job off that guy or just come over on your own?
I took the job.
Okay.
Yeah, because we were not in the EU. So I could not work.
I forgot.
I could not just land here and be a journalist or be what I was at home. So you had to. But, you know, I was 22, 23. You know, why not?
That's brilliant.
So.
What were you doing? I can imagine you going around with like a walkie-talkie all clear on the second floor.
Well, to be honest, my first gig was in Drogheda.
Okay.
In the Coca-Cola place.
Oh, yeah.
It was a night shift.
Oh,
I had to go around. It was night. It was raining. Huge place. Uh-huh. And you have these kind of checkpoints that you have to do. So every hour. So there I am.
Oh,
I'm 22, 23, whatever. I'm going around 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m., whatever. I was actually laughing to myself saying, if my parents or my friends would see me, would think that I'm mad. Like, what are you doing?
I left for this.
But I had a plan. I was like, well, I'll do this for a while and then I'll go to school. And then long story short, I was able to actually take the education from home. I did media marketing here and they gave me a year. Like they kind of matched. It was a equivalency or whatever the thing is called. So I got to then go and do a media and marketing degree here and all this kind of stuff. So I had a plan and I wasn't taking myself or the situation too seriously. So I was able to. So I did that for a year and a half. I was in security.
A year and a half.
Yeah, Blanchardstown Shopping Centre.
Wow.
Going around.
All night.
How
did you manage the night shift? Because I often see people. I used to live down by the Docklands there and there's a guy in the security hut. If I was coming home at night or often actually I'd be going out very early in the morning, maybe at 5, and I'd see him sitting there.
You read a lot. You read or people would watch things. You'd have like your little TV or something because you'll go nuts. So you have to do something.
It's so long.
It is very long because usually these shifts were 14, 16 hours as well.
Really?
Yeah. So
that is
my little story of coming here.
And it's a great story though.
Yeah, it is.
Now. Great story now.
Great story now. Like I actually remember, and with that, I'll stop this part of the story. But I remember my second gig was on Henry Street and one of the shops. I could not understand what anyone is saying in the walkie-talkies.
Because
you're linked with everyone else, not just with your own kind of company.
You see that even now,
I could not get, like, the accents. I was like, I don't know, is this for me? What are people? I was lost. It was mad.
That'd be much tougher now. Yeah. There's so much going on. Obviously, I was up there this morning, actually. There's a lot going on. So,
yeah, that was really.
I was just shouting at each other in the middle of the street. And I was like, looking at them going, I don't know if they're friends, if they're like having a row. I wasn't sure what was going on. So that was this morning. So yeah, I can kind of understand what it was like a few years ago.
Yeah, so a startup is nothing compared to that.
But isn't it funny though? All of those experiences all kind of add up. Mm. So did you work in journalism here after that then? Or did you just go straight into tech?
I went into, so apart from my little security thing until I could get back in college and come out of it, I more or less went into tech. But funny enough, in 2014, I got to my two loves, that of journalism and tech, came together when I got a call from the Indo.
Okay.
And they said, we put together this new business and it has its own MD, and we have about 6 product managers and we need help. Would you come in and see if you can help them?
Okay.
So at that stage, I was teaching product management. I put together a course, whatever. So I go in, I just think that it's a small gig, give a talk and, you know. Mm. And without anyone looking at a CV or anything, they literally asked me, would you like to stay as a head of product? And I did for 6 months. And that was very interesting because it didn't work out, unfortunately. And by the time I was gone, the MD was gone and pretty much everyone.
I remember that project being talked about, all right?
It was, but what could have been, like, I was really surprised to go in there and find amazing data scientists. There were 4 or 5 data scientists that today work for all the cool data science companies here in Dublin. It was an amazing team. And there was just so, and everyone was really, because media, it's an interesting area that gets, quote unquote, for those that don't see me right now, disrupted. Mm-hmm. And it was just, we were all in it.
But everyone's trying to figure it out as well. Everyone's trying to get that, be that one person that figures it out.
But it just, it didn't work. So anyway, I was in there for 6 months and that was really cool for me because I was back in the world to some extent, although I wasn't writing, but I would, you would have to work with the journalists and then with the digital team to come up with new ways of doing things. Mm. But other than that, I published every now and then. There's the stuff that I wrote that the Irish Tech News or someone decided to publish it or whatever. But I would like at some stage more time to go back and write.
Still there. Mm. Your book, maybe.
Yeah.
So then you went to another couple of companies before opening, or is the opening next?
Yeah. No, I did a company called Brandalism. So we were based here in Dublin, Ranelagh. And Brandalism was, I guess it kind of was my love and hate relationship with marketing and branding and all that world, which can be fluffy and a bit, you know, what works down, and what doesn't work, all that. So I can't remember even when that started, but anyway, I did that for 4 or 5 years. So going into the Indo was the last 6 months of that company.
Okay.
I was actually, maybe a week before that call came in from the Indo, I was ready to close it. But I already started talking to Adrian, so we were already playing with opening at that stage. And Brandalism was good. We had a lot of interesting things that we've done. You know, we would build products or strategies or branding or whatever for startups with money or even universities. Like I remember doing a piece of work for DCU Languages where, you know, the concept of mystery shopper. I had to be that for one of their language courses.
Oh, wow.
So from going to the website, booking the course, going in, sitting the exam.
Really?
I sat the exam. I felt so bad because obviously you can hear my English and I've been here. So I spoke very little and I tried to not sound kind of.
Okay. And how long was that for?
That was a project. It took a few weeks or whatever, and then I had to present in front of the CEO and everyone else that so that was an interesting one. I actually had a really lot before accepting. I didn't feel comfortable in doing that. And then in the end I was like, okay, I'll accept it, because I just felt I'm gonna, you know, pretend that I am something or I'm doing something that I'm not. But it was a really, really good result in the end. And I presented to the whole team, including the lecturers and the examiners. And they were like, I could see you were taking notes. And I was so annoyed. I was like, why is she not paying attention? What is she writing? So Brandalism was really cool because we had various different projects. And part of that, I got to teach things like product management as well as a side kind of gig. And at the same time, a friend of mine approached me and asked me to lead the Irish part of this European kind of network of five companies and the university, the Fraunhofer University in Germany, where we had this fund that we invested in European and Israeli startups without equity. So we would not take equity, but we would offer mentoring. And so that took me around to Berlin and London and Tel Aviv a bit. And
when you say they don't take equity, what was then in it? Was it like a pro bono kind of fund, or what was the goal?
The European so we in the EU and the European Commission decided that we need to build our own technology. So they built this thing called FIware. So the catch was for you to use FIware technology, build, you know, have a high potential startup business of sorts, but use this FIware tech within the architecture of your product. Truthfully, most companies would use some tiny module.
Stamp it on there and then get the funding.
In order to get the funding. But really good people involved, some amazing startups in there. And one of them is on their way to becoming a unicorn, European unicorn. They just closed like a huge funding round last year. So it was just very cool to see where some of these companies went. And it was just such an amazing experience.
That's extremely cool. So what would you do? What would your involvement be? That sounds like a great job.
So we had two calls. We had 4.5 million euros and two calls.
4.5
million.
Okay.
To distribute,
okay, yeah,
you know, and the maximum that we could give to one startup was 250k.
Okay, so it's chunky. Yeah, it's enough to
you know, it helps, and colossal. Then it's no equity,
yeah,
which is, you know,
the holy grail.
And it wasn't. You could work from. You had to give 3 days, 2-3 days every quarter.
Okay.
You had to go and, you know, do some on-site stuff, but otherwise there were startups from all over, from Spain, from UK, from Tel Aviv, from everywhere. And really, so we would put the call out there and we would say, you know, we're looking for a new cohort. Applications would come in. So I remember doing a 24-hour of going through 86 applications and rating them, and literally go through we asked for decks, we asked for financial information. Some of them had some supporting information. They had a questionnaire to fill. So go to every single one. We were three people who were doing that. So, you know, not just one person would put a stamp on. So you would have to do that. So that was step one. And then that's the funnel, basically. You would eventually pick 10 to 12 startups.
Okay.
And then the program would kick in. So I don't know if it was every month now. Every month and a half, you would meet them somewhere and you would spend 3-4 days with them.
Okay.
And bring in speakers, do one-to-one mentoring. And then you had to do it remotely as well. So all these startups could access you at any stage and ask you things.
Interesting, but a lot of calls.
But that was towards the end of Brandalism as well, when I just felt that we were building stuff for other people, and I felt that I would like to build something of my own. And every now and then I would get approached by startups in Dublin, go, would you join as a co-founder and all this? But I couldn't, I was looking for deep tech.
Right.
And then when Adrian moved here, I just knew that this guy is a genius. So
had you known him previously?
Yeah, since I'm a teenager, I was 16, or whatever. We kind of had the same friends.
And, yeah.
Yeah, and he was always with the cool gang. You know, everything.
It's quite rare, though, isn't it? Like, you know someone for that length of time, and then they come here. It's quite serendipitous.
Yeah, I mean, I was already here maybe 12 years or whatever. Okay. I get a random email saying, hey, I'm moving to Dublin. And I'm like, oh my God. So the first week that he's here, I'm speaking in Google for startups about something. So I invite him and I go, well, might as well you get, you know, you get to know the community, start coming to these things. And then we would all just kind of hang out. And then we started thinking about stuff. And as I said, weekends, nights, and it turned into a thing.
But you had such a good experience from all your past stuff, but then also the incubator, like that, that been able to look probably unemotionally at startups and kind of without a vested interest in going, well, that doesn't make sense, and been able to apply that to yourself. Were you still able to bring that kind of knowledge with you, or is it different when you're doing your own?
It's very different when you're doing your own. Like, even in when we first set up, we put our in our own money, and you know, we had ridiculous notions that we will make it without taking money from places. Everything will take three times longer. But anyway, we were
treble it. So that's sort of a good mindset to me. Like, whatever you think it'll take in time and money, treble it.
Yeah,
it's a great good rule of thumb. It's never that far, maybe higher, but it's never far on.
Probably higher. But anyway, so first we put in our own money, and then we get into NDRC, who go, look, we'll give you 100 grand.
Okay. Did you start off the two of you, or is did you start off with a few more people?
It was just the two of us.
Okay.
And then we go into NDRC, and we go up to, we actually paid people out of our own money as well. So our team kind of expanded and contracted based on whatever, our own funds and stuff. But when we got into NDRC, like, I had a bit of history there that I would go and mentor startups in there and all this.
Didn't know who you were, I knew your pedigree.
And yeah, and just know all the startup weekends, like, I would see Gary from NDRC talk about the same. I felt that I knew it. And then I go in there, and I had a little bit of a, I had a bit of a struggle. So I needed, it was okay in 2 weeks, but I had a little bit of an ego. I had a bit
of a... The teacher's becoming the students, so it's kind of hard to go back.
Oh, I know this. Yeah. Oh, this is not, I don't need to do this. I'm wasting my time. But then you realize very quickly that actually, no, you need to, because you don't know, you're too close to it. Everything just, it's very easy to watch someone put something together and give your opinion on why that could be better, or it could be, but put the thing together and then you'll have a different experience of the process. So I had to unlearn or realize or accept that, okay, maybe I know nothing, and let's just start from there. And
that's hard though, you know, because, you know, you do know a lot and you've been through a lot of the similar process. What brought you to NDRC? Was it just for the funding, or was it just the structure? So that's an incubator. Sorry, for anyone listening who's not sure what that is, that's like a startup accelerator incubator.
Yeah, that's correct. And they have different programs, and we went into this program called Catalyzer that was aimed at deep tech. To be honest, I mean, we needed the money. We were stuck, and we were still so early.
How far into it, the journey was this?
I mean, it was, we were in it maybe a year or whatever, but it was mostly part-time, evenings, all that kind of stuff. So we needed to make a decision. What are we doing with this thing? And most of it, if not all, it really comes down to our venture leader in there, who's Dermot Casey. And Dermot, I don't know if
you said the name, I know I met.
Yeah, so Dermot was part of Storyful. He was CEO in Storyful. Dermot was someone that I knew since forever. And we went in and we pitched. It took us two or three times. I was just so agree. I said, why are they not getting me in this business?
Well, so you applied and get it.
Oh my God. It was the whole, it was. So life just has a way of going, sit down.
Yeah.
You know, but him, in the end, we got the offer. We weren't sure. So after we got the offer, we weren't sure anymore. But it was really him. Come on in, Andrea. He got me to speak to other founders who have gotten money before. So I got on a call with people. I've done that in time too for others as well. But for us, it was really, really important to have that person. And, you know, Dermot will always be there, and he still helps us even today. Like I mentioned, the offsite that we had last year in December in 2019, just before Christmas, we again I put a thing out on Twitter, and I asked, we're doing this offsite. We want someone to facilitate the thing. I don't want it to be me. And he immediately DM'd and said, look, I'll come in and I'll do this.
Because not everyone could do that. It's quite a, it's a bit, it's a skill.
Yeah. And he knows our business.
So you weren't catching someone up. You weren't kind of giving them a half a day pitch on what it is to understand it. Okay.
Yeah. So he's been really, really good to us. So that's kind of how that happened, I guess. He was just, come on.
It's people, though. It's always people, isn't it?
That it really, really is.
It's relationships. That's... You touched on it at the very start of why you were explaining about opening.io. It's always about people.
Yeah.
It's a serendipitous meeting of you and me and someone else. And, oh, I know that guy and I know this guy. And it's always that. Mm-hmm. Like, it's never really the... Your idea has to be good, obviously, but it's always the personal relationships that kind of move things in a different direction.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, ideas are nothing without someone implementing them. And then you will not be enough because you need help. Like, even I remember before opening, so I used to do just loads of other things within the community, the startup weekends, and I had this thing called Askathon that we would hold in the Science Gallery and the Startup Hiking, and very often with Brandalism, the previous company, sometimes I had periods of time where 75% of what I was doing was for free and volunteering and 25% was actually bringing in any money. But I could live, and
you enjoyed it as well,
I just really loved it.
Yeah.
And I just gave, I never asked for anything. And then opening came and I decided to go full time after I came out of Indo. And I realized that, you know, your savings will go away, and what will happen next? You'll end up homeless or what? So I had to send an email to some friends, people that I knew that I trusted. I said, I need help. Can you give me... not even asking from them directly, but do you know anyone who's looking for a couple of days of consultancy that I could do?
Okay.
And email comes back within the hour from this person who's at this big event in the UK, but they're here. And they were very busy where they were. And he emails back and says, actually, we might have something. And a couple of days later, it's confirmed. And I have my gig 2 to 3 days a month for the next 6-7 months.
Magic. And that gives you the sense of security.
Yeah. And that was all because there was a network. Because I've never asked that date anything. And I genuinely just did things because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed helping. I enjoyed bringing things together. But then at some stage, you know, everything connects, and sometimes you need to ask for help or you need to,
But it's it could be 6 months, could be 6 years, it could be just total random.
Completely, because you don't do things for...
You can't. I think that's a very short term. I think there's a few people in the startup world are a bit like that. They kind of do things to expect. If I do this for you, you do this for me, around and around we go. And they're constantly in that pitch mode.
Yeah, I'm not comfortable with any of that.
It just rots me. I just can't apply. It's just pointless. Like, you know what I mean? I'm not your audience, buddy. Like, just relax. Take a breath. You know what I mean? Don't want your business card. So it's kind of like that scene, I think, whereby a lot of people are just kind of constantly thinking that's the way they should be doing a job. You know, sell, you know. So what happened? When you get into your season, what happened next? You kind of started building out the product and...
Starting building the product, we brought on our first industry expert, really. So our first full-time employee. So someone who used to be in Google, who came out as a, you know, and started a company, and he was a founder of a company, sent me an email with a CV attached in September 2016, going, this person came here, she was looking for a job, I think she might be more suitable for you, do you want to meet her? So September 2016, I meet Lena, who's still with us, who in January 2017 joins us officially because we got the money in December from...
Okay, waiting for that check.
And she is super senior. So she was a senior marketing manager in Hays, very interested in tech,
okay,
understands that the space she's in is changing, started going to startup weekends, exploring whatever.
Interesting. So Hays, for anyone who doesn't know, is a big recruitment company here in Dublin.
Yeah.
So she could bridge the gap from recruitment to tech for you. Interesting.
Exactly. And she was a recruiter, although her, like, you know, her role at that time was a senior marketing manager. She worked as a recruiter in the past. Mm.
Deep industry knowledge then to be able to kind of give
deep
that to
industry
you.
Knowledge, curious, willing, and someone who was not from here. She's from Moscow.
Okay.
She really wanted to stay here because she's been back and forth to Ireland. At that stage, she was a senior marketing manager here in Dublin for Hays Ireland, but she actually set up Hays in Russia together with one other person, and that grew to 200 people and all that. She went to Trinity before that, so she was very much, this is my home, I want to stay here. She was on a visa with Hays, but she was like, I'm actually going to let that go and put it out there into the universe. It was okay, a bit of a mad
it's
move.
A similar theme for you, actually. This is kind of a, the universe has served all of you guys well.
You know, and I meet her in September and I'm like, man, I'd love to work with you, but I can't pay you. Like, how? Okay. I was like, don't go anywhere, hang in there. And she's saying, look, my gig is ending, I think, in the end of September or something. I have some savings. I'm going to go home as well for a little while. But, you know, a month and a half or whatever, 2 months later, we were able to offer her a
full-time. Oh, was she your first hire?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So she joins and then somebody else joins. And anyway, joining NDRC, it's a six-month program, at the end of which there is this thing called an investor day, which is very much like any other incubator or accelerator. There's a cohort that goes through a program, and at the end they get onto a stage, they do a few minutes of pitching, there's a judges, and someone wins, and we won. So we got a bit more funding from them, and that was great. And then we stayed there. We actually ended up staying in NDRC for 1 year and 8 months because we could for free. And it was a really lovely space there. And we just started, you know, building, just trying to sell, productize, build up the technology better. Then we raised again. And this is not a secret that Anne Herity invested in us, who's the CEO of CPL, which is a really large recruitment agency here, just under 600 million euros in revenues last year. Mm. She's also the longest standing CEO in Ireland.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah. She's the longest standing CEO in Ireland. And she's also the first woman who IPO'd on the UK stock exchange, brought her company public.
You can put in a good word for us. That's amazing. If you were picking probably your dream investor here in Ireland, she'd be probably on the top.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
They were already a client. So when we, at some stage, we come out of beta and we change our website and we put it out there, and the first person who logs in, because at that stage you could log into the mini ATS that I manage, the mini applicant tracking system, and we see an email address, first person who logs in, and it's from CPL, and it's the CTO of CPL.
Oh, wow.
And our chairman knows him, and we go and we meet him. And long story short, they become a client. And Anne keeps hearing good things about us. So we had a coffee, and she literally asked, are you looking, are you raising?
Wow. Where are you?
Kind of, yeah.
We were then.
But I just never approached her. At that time, we were like, should we... We were thinking, would that affect our independence or perceived independence and all that?
But, yeah, I know what you mean.
But it wasn't CPL investing in us, really. So it didn't really make a difference. On the contrary, just getting her on board, that kind of validation was amazing. And then Enterprise Ireland, and then we went through a little bit of a hell. We had €1 million on the table from someone, and we were closing, and we were gonna close 1.5, and the million evaporated, and we literally got ghosted by the investor.
I love that description.
Just
wow.
Over Christmas.
Stop replying to your WhatsApps.
That's
wow.
Yeah, over Christmas. Yeah. And then we had someone else who we were going to close with another investor. Due diligence, his team comes over from London, due diligence done. Everything great. We're in with the lawyers now. We're literally putting the stuff together. He goes on holidays, comes back, goes, actually, I'm going to maybe wait a few more months. Why don't you just take money from these other guys and I'll just wait? That made the whole thing collapse, because suddenly we were vulnerable. And
a friend of mine is going through a similar process, and the mental torture and the power playing is crazy. He was explaining it to me. I was like, that is nuts.
It is.
You're watching what I'm doing, and if I pull, you know you've now leveraged on me, so you're going to pull a little bit more.
It is. Oof. Chess. But it's I was watching the other night on Netflix. There's this, I don't know what it's called, but it's about Mehmed, the Sultan of... I'm very interested in... It's the taking of Constantinople.
Okay.
Which is Istanbul today. And I'm very interested in strategic stuff. I used to play strategy games. Okay. And I just have a weird affinity, which is just romantic, of war, but more strategic kind of moves and whatever. And I was watching that last night, because it's quite interesting, and thinking how very much it aligns with what you go through when you're trying to build a business and you need to grow it, and what growth means, and bringing in people, and what that process will take you through, and all the things that will go wrong, which are normal. But unfortunately, here in Ireland, in Silicon Valley or whatever, in the States, you can go and talk to 300 investors if you wish. Here, you might have 5 or something. Yeah. And things go wrong all the time for reasons. People disappear, investment disappears, people change their mind just like that because of reasons. But when you have access to fewer and fewer resources, because, you know, then it can be devastating. And then you don't know what you don't know.
Something completely left field happens very, very far away, not related to you, suddenly has a knock-on effect that they pull the funding because another one, their investment's tanked, and suddenly you're tanking because a totally unrelated thing happens. Yeah, people forget that side of business. That's why I love discussing it in the podcast, because people kind of see the veneer of you outside going, geez, she's doing great. She's fine. She raised loads of money, didn't she? You know, people forget, like, it's a process.
Oh my goodness, it is just so...
What happened when he ghosted you? You then had to go for another round of getting other people involved.
In the end, we just closed with the people. At the end of that process, I actually had another investor interested.
Okay.
But at that stage, we had to close. So we made a decision, look, we're not taking any more money right now. We're closing this as is, and we're gonna just put you on hold there, and you'll get a shot to invest when we go again, if we go again, whatever. So we had to, sometimes you have to, these are the types of decisions that you have to make. Because bringing in someone new would have added weeks or months. It's just, you can't.
Clock's ticking. People still need to get paid.
Yeah. So we just, and the last year for us, really, we just focused on growth and the States.
Okay.
Most of our clients are in the States.
Really?
So second half of last year, I was there nearly every month.
Wow.
And we got some very good clients who are number ones in their area. Which is really, really great. So these are the types of logos that few years back we could only dream of. So yeah, last year was all about let's grow this. So after NDRC, we actually, as I said, we stayed there a year and 8 months. And then the next move was into Dogpatch Labs and in the CHQ. And Dogpatch is just such a community hub. It's you could call it a co-working space, but it's so much more than that. It's really a community hub. And it's just a space that it's great for us. So yeah, we moved in there and we said, okay, let's focus on growth. Take it as far as we can with the resources that we have. And now we're again at an interesting stage where we're considering, you know, where do we go next?
Okay.
So.
Westwards. Just let that hang there. That's really interesting though. And the moving to the States, you know, targeting the clients over there, it's such a genius strategy. You always hear kind of people saying, oh, you got to go to the States. But imagine, how did you strategize that? You talked about strategy earlier. How did you go, right, we're going to go to the States?
I'll use a word I don't necessarily like, but it is hustle.
Hustle 24/7, 365,
I think just hustle in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, hustle smart.
I think just one thing that we did was not position as a startup. So we went to industry events. So we don't go to any startup kind of conferences and events. We don't do that. But we decided we're going to align with industry events, go to them, and ideally do something that will get me on a stage to talk about what we're doing.
Be the authority.
So we didn't really, it was actually first time last year when we got a startup booth at this big conference in Vegas. But that was also because we've learned, well, it cost us a lot, the whole thing, to go over there. But we've learned that there was an area of focus that everyone would come there. They were very interested in what was new. So it was a really good, really, really good place to be in. But really, we haven't done that. Our strategy was not to get a startup booth. And our strategy was get yourself on a stage. Yeah. Go and talk about these things.
I think it's the genius strategy. I think it's so smart.
And it kind of worked for us. And it created... and also because the area that we're in is really current and it's very relevant. Because we worked on all these things and we went places, there's content that was created around us. So then we got good SEO without us doing any SEO work at all. And then we would literally just get inbound. Our first couple of years or more were all inbound traffic. And then the States, I guess, it's a mix of identifying who are the voices that talk about who have authority in this industry and how can you align with them. We ended up, again, I'm just like, we're not about startup things. I'm not really about competitions. We never went and pitched, really. I think we did it once at a European Commission thing at CeBIT in Hanover. That wasn't really getting on a stage and pitch. But last year we did, after I threw a little bit of a tantrum that I'm not doing it, we... in front of the team, they were like, okay. I went and I did it and we won it.
Oh, wow.
And this was against companies that have raised a lot more than us and maybe more mature. And we won that. And that was in an event in Europe that was organized by an entity who is from North America. But it was their second European event kind of thing. And that really put us onto, people were like, oh, you're legit. So there was
suddenly that veneer of credibility. It can be from a mainstream media outlet or something, but often people just need that little stamp of
So it was just a mix of, and you know, we're right now interested in the English speaking market because our matching tech works in English. The way we built it, it's actually language agnostic, but we would need access to data. If we wanted to work in French, we need French CVs and whatever. And we were very, very careful of how we build our tech. We don't buy data, which is it's kind of like a normal thing in our industry. You could do that, but we don't do any of that. So we just grew with our clients and we grew in a way that we're a bit paranoid about privacy and all this kind of stuff, and most of us are not on certain social platforms, and we were just, we don't have
that's funny, I know exactly what you're talking about, so I tried to find you yesterday.
That's my design. So there's no smart stuff in the house. We literally project onto the walls.
Oh well, my brother-in-law listens to you, he's always paranoid about that sort of stuff.
We're informed. So, and we care, we genuinely care
industry
about
you're
these
in,
things.
I mean, I think you know, you're operating at such a level that what you are talking about is valuable. So
So you know, so I guess for us was just anyway, to go back to the whole stays thing. I guess positioning was important. Doing some moves, like, you know, winning that competition was great. And you can go in to win, but that's not guaranteed.
Yeah.
But it, you know,
you only have so many hours in the day. You only have so much resources. If you're doing that, you're not off doing something else. So yeah, it's a big commitment.
But you know, last year was really good, and I think traction then happens once you get a couple of logos and once your clients are willing to talk about the fact that they work with you, because once they do, you know, it all just changes. And we were very lucky that we actually launched our new site yesterday.
Okay.
We didn't talk about it because we're still tweaking it, and it's been a long
time.
This is
the official launch.
Funny enough, yeah. But before that, we went out to our clients and we said, can you give us testimonials? And everyone said yes. And
okay.
We were very, very happy. And even the fact that I randomly on our one of our clients' website, I'm checking something and I see that they have a page for Applied AI. And I go in there and I see our name. And I didn't even know that they have us on our website, and they talk about IBM Watson and us and, you know, all these kind of things. Add up and getting that validation and endorsement from our clients help, and kind of, and with the States, I guess with any other territory, everyone wants to know that you already have clients there.
Okay.
And it gets easier after you get your first.
Okay, it's a chicken and egg.
Yeah. So
that's interesting. I have two final questions for you. The last one, I'll let you think about it for a second. Each week we give away a book.
Okay.
So if you can think of a book that you'd recommend to everyone's listening. So it can be a business book. It can be anything. It can be a book that's had an impact on you. It can be a book you just enjoyed. It doesn't really have to be any kind of book. We give it away. They can just apply and we'll give it away to them. Second last question is, how do you plan? This is just for me. How do you plan your kind of quarter, week, year?
So okay.
How do you look ahead and kind of go, all right? Because you're obviously extremely busy.
Okay, book wise, funny enough, you know, we're living in interesting times, right? And very often you see a certain book being quoted, and I realized that I never actually, or referenced, and I've never actually read it until literally a month and a half ago, when I said, I need to read this.
I'm really curious what this is now.
So this is it's because of what the world we live in is, and all the extremist things.
Yeah.
There is one book that gets referenced, and especially the whole Big Brother.
Okay, I know where we're going. Yeah.
So it's that book.
Okay, you can say it.
So I think it would be, I think, and I don't know, it doesn't have to be. Actually, when I left the house today, I was I turned 40 in August.
Okay, congratulations.
Thank you. And I asked people to just buy me books.
Okay.
And I was very interested in geopolitics, and I got gifted a bunch of books which I have not read. And I actually glanced at them. I guess this is what I want to say, as I was walking out today.
Okay.
And one of them is a Revenge of Geography.
Okay.
I think it's very interesting to understand where we are today, why some of these things are happening, and what's the context for it. But that could be a bit more obscure. But I think the Big Brother book.
Okay. So George Orwell.
Yeah.
It's a good recommendation. That could be, that's never been recommended. Brilliant.
Because it's just, I just found, I know there's a film out there and whatever, but I just found that we go back to that because it just really strikes a chord and it's just so on point. But yeah, I never read it.
I have that on my shelf at home. I actually haven't read it yet. So therefore, that's going to prompt me to go back and read it. And then just in terms of your productivity, how do you plan ahead? Like, how do you keep everything moving?
Really good question. And it's so tough when you're a startup because we can move really fast. So that's not a problem. But long term for us is 3 months, really. We have a thing for the year and we go, by the end of the year, we want to do this and this and this. And we know that a lot of the stuff that we do is in R&D mode and that will take time.
Right.
There's no, you know, we're looking at this cross-lingual matching now, which would be like a world first, CVs in Japanese to jobs in French or something. Mm. And we go, can we crack that? And how long will it take? So I think the blessing and the curse as a startup is that you're able to execute fast, but something can change tomorrow because a client will ask for something or a new client pops in and asks, are you integrated into this platform? And you have to leave everything and you have to do that. So, but at the same time, you have to have your vision and your goals and all that. So actually, there's a big planning session going on right now in the office. Tech is doing that. And for the first time, my colleague Lena, who is the head of business development, she wants, within her career path, she wants to move into product marketing management.
Okay.
So she decided that as of today, she's joining the tech planning sessions. And within them, some of the conversations are just deeply technical and they really, it's DevOps stuff or it's, I don't know, server side scale issues, which, you know. So we do, the guys we have sprints, you know, so we know what we're doing every two weeks.
How do you keep yourself on point?
Well, I guess we have to, at the very beginning, we productized a lot. So we overbuilt.
Okay.
Because we're a product, we have this product DNA, we absolutely overbuilt because we could and we found it interesting.
Okay.
And then we were like, okay, what are we doing? Like, who is this even for? Not that is it relevant or not, because as the kind of times goes by, you can see that this piece really belongs here and this customer really wants it, but we overbuilt. So I guess what we do today is really just listen to the market, listen to our clients, listen to our clients' clients. So very often we go to events that we won't find our direct market.
Interesting.
But we listen to what they're saying and the challenges that they have. So we can then go and help our own clients, who is the industry.
They can build down, yeah.
Build for them. So we pay a lot of attention to that. We have some big goals. There's always R&D work related to that stuff you have, and it's out there. But yeah, we get into a room and we discuss, you know, what are we doing? And sometimes our clients will ask what's on your roadmap. So it kind of forces us to be able to have that at hand and know what the answer is. But look, it's complicated because things can change just like that by someone saying, I want you integrated into this thing, and we're not, and everything has to stop and we have to. Or a client that goes, well, I have these many data points, and suddenly you realize I have to stop everything and raise another 10 servers or something, or who knows what. But just, I guess, the whole listen to your customer is key, to be honest. Key. And as a company who is absolutely guilty of overbuilding in the past, we've sort of learned that, and now we're like, no.
That's
do
great
we
advice.
Absolutely have to do that? No. Can we buy it? Yes. Okay, good. Is it core?
Yeah.
You know.
Brilliant. Listen, Andrea, thank you so much for coming in.
No worries. Thank you so much for this. And
where
thank
can
you.
People learn a little bit more about opening?
Opening.io. So that's a place to go to. We're on Twitter, we're on LinkedIn. But I guess the website, we're not very, we don't put a lot of stuff out there. Social, okay. Our social media game is not strong. So go okay, to the
so
website.
Okay, so open.io or LinkedIn or something like that.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Great,
or talk to me.
Yes, reach out. You're big on Twitter as well yourself personally.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. Listen, thank you so much.
No, thank you. And thanks to everyone.
And that was episode 2 of season 2 in the Entrepreneur Experiment. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you do, please get in touch with any feedback you have or any suggestions for people you'd love to hear on this season. If you want to win the book that Andrea was talking about by George Orwell, 1984, just share the episode on social media and tag Opening and me, Mr. Gary Fox, to be in a chance to win. If you want to learn more about Opening or Andrea, you can go to opening.io, and the best place to get Andrea is on Twitter and LinkedIn. I will see you next week, next Thursday at 6 a.m. for next episode. See you then.